Thanks. Oh boy, that's I can even hear me now. That's bad. Okay, so if you take those parameters, delta m and the angle, and express it as a two-dimensional plot, where what we're putting on here is what you would get for example, solar neutrinos as a two-parameter fit to the data, delta m12 in this case, and theta 1,2, and it turns out it's not degenerate with what you get for atmospheric, which would be delta m23 and theta 2,3. And so you can put it all on one plot if you take those liberties, and that's in fact what the particle data group does. This is what a particle data group summary looked like in 2004. Since then, there's been a greater definition of the region of acceptance in solar and reactor experiments, and it's really quite well defined. I'll show you even some new data that does even better on that. Well defined both in terms of delta m and in terms of tan squared theta. It's also the line of demarcation of tan squared theta equals 1. It gives you a delineation of whether or not the hierarchy is such that mass 2 is greater than mass 1 and mass 3 is greater than mass 2. And in the case of solar and Camland, because of the matter effects, we know mass 2 is greater than mass 1. We don't know that yet for atmospheric, and hence it spans the tan squared theta equals 1 value. LSND has a region of acceptance way up here at about an electron volt in delta m squared, and ruling that in or out by Miniboon is going to be a very important question as we go forward. You can see the data here. The statistics is low, but it's certainly not impossible if that's correct. The data for Superchem Ukanda and atmospheric oscillation is very clear, and I'll show you the situation in solar and the latest results for that. Okay, what's shown is the delta M for, in the case of the solar, for a situation where because the delta M's are not degenerate, you're just looking really at that term there. Delta M12 for the solar and reactor case, and the tangent of theta 1,2 for that part of the matrix. And then on the same plot, there is shown delta m23 and the angle 2,3 for the other case of atmospheric. And in the case of the LSND data, what you're seeing is something which would have to be completely different, but is expressed in terms of delta m and theta for those particular terms. Yeah. Say that again. Two. Delta M and theta. And that is the acceptance region for the finite effects that have been observed. And it's exclusion regions for these other experiments up here. The blue is acceptance region where finite effects have been observed. That's right. But if you also have a finite effect for LSND, you need more than 3, because you can't get 2 different delta M squareds, pardon me, 3 different delta M squareds if you only have 3 neutrinos. Yes, but that's not necessarily a relevant in terms of CP or CPT or anything like that. It really, the implication of being able to fit it in to this model would be that you'd have to have more neutrino types coming in. That's right. True, but you may want to go somewhere else other than that, if that turns out to be the case. Yes.
So
One doesn't know that. All one knows is that they go from an electron neutrino to other active neutrino types. That's the measurement that has been made. And oh, I'm sorry. Here, it should say mu comma tau on the previous one. This one? That's right. Yeah. Okay. Solar, for quite a while, was a puzzle because if you look at the comparison between the blue bars, which are the experimental results up to this point for these set of experiments in water here, chlorine here, and gallium here, this is the historic measurement by Ray Davis, in which he sees about one-third of what is predicted by theory, where the theory is different solar reactions contributing to the total number that you would expect to see. This certainly was suggestive that there was a problem, but it was hard to know whether what was happening was that you weren't sensitive to the neutrino types into which neutrinos had transformed, or whether the models were such that since you have different combinations of reactions and also were dependent upon a comparison with a model, whether the models were simply not accurate enough to make the predictions. With heavy water in the snow experiment, as I'll show you in a moment, we were able to make a measurement with a type of reaction that is specifically sensitive to electron neutrinos and also make a measurement with a reaction that is equally sensitive to all neutrino types. And by making a comparison between those two measurements, as opposed to necessarily a comparison with solar models, you can show that all neutrino types are what you observe in the reaction that you, where you're sensitive to those, and that that's about three times what you observe specifically for electron neutrinos. You also observe that you're in good agreement with solar models when you look at all neutrino types, and that's a nice confirmation of those solar models. But in fact, the measurement was a particle physics measurement independent of the solar models. How do we do it? All water detectors can observe scattering from electrons by all neutrino types, but dominated by the electron neutrino sensitivity. You're about six times more sensitive to electron neutrinos than the other types. And so that is one thing we can observe, and it is a cone of light in the forward direction produced by the electron after it has been hit by the neutrino. What we did with snow, having heavy water, is to do two reactions. One, the reaction where the electron neutrino comes in, strikes the neutron in the deuteron nucleus, turns it into a proton and a fast-moving electron that produces the cone of light that we've been talking about. And this reaction has a relatively weak directional sensitivity, but it's electrons only, and it's a relatively large cross-section compared to the scattering off electrons. Another reaction with a relatively large cross-section is one where the neutrino and any type of neutrino comes in and basically splits the deuteron apart into a proton and a free neutron, which very quickly thermalizes in the heavy water and can be captured in the first phase of the experiment by the heavy water itself, or in the second phase by a chlorine nucleus that we've added to the water. And so those two so-called, in this case, charge current reaction and neutral current reaction can be compared. And in fact, the results from snow amount to that comparison. In fact, the first thing we reported back in 2001 was a comparison with Superchemiocandes elastic scattering measurements in light water. And taking advantage of the small sensitivity that you have for mu and tau, we had a small statistically significant deviation, but only at about the three standard deviation level. When we put on the full power of snow with a comparison of charge current with neutral current and looked at all neutrino types, we were able to get 5 sigma, in other words, at the discovery potential level, and then in more recent data, greater than 7 sigma, confirmation that in fact one has neutrino flavor transformation taking place from electron neutrinos in the sun changing into other active neutrino types that are observed by this neutral current reaction that's equally sensitive to all types. At the same time, you can take a look at how the total flux of all neutrinos compares with solar models, and in fact, we're now more accurate than the models with our experimental results and have a 10% uncertainty in that flux. We did it with this detector that is 1,000 tons of heavy water worth about 300 million Canadian that we were able to obtain on loan for a dollar, which is not bad leverage in any economic system. And we housed it in a transparent acrylic sphere, looked at it with 10,000 phototubes that are capable of observing a single photon of light with a 25% probability. And so we had a very sensitive detector of the very faint bursts of light that are produced when a neutrino comes through the 2 kilometers of Earth and strikes the heavy water, which happens only about once an hour. And so stringent cleanliness, everybody who came in from the point at which we closed the cavity, which by the way is filled with ultra-pure light water outside this, so this is kind of floating in that light water. Everyone who came in to do the construction work took a shower, put on clean, lint-free clothing, and we've had 60 to 70,000 showers so far in order to make this happen. But as I'll show you later, we can get data that's neutrinos and essentially no radioactive background, and so it's been worthwhile. And this process of keeping the whole laboratory clean as you build is what we're going to do for the snow lab as well, and that will be of tremendous advantage. That, in addition to the fact that at 2 kilometers underground, we're significantly lower in cosmic ray flux than any other observatory. And this cleanliness factor really helps you in terms of observing very faint processes. So that's what snow was looks like. We observed the light produced by the neutrinos. We did it in three phases. We're now in the third phase. First phase, we observed that second neutral current reaction by observing the neutron capturing on deuterium, producing a 6 MeV gamma ray that comes out and produces light just as the charged current reaction does, and you have to work out ways to deal with the sum of those signals, but they are able to be, you can come to a conclusion that neutrinos are changing their flavor by looking at the sum of those signals. But it's even better when you get the chlorine, because then you have a different signature for the neutron capturing on chlorine than you do for the charge current reaction. In this case, it's multiple gamma rays. In the case of the charge current reaction, it's a cone of light. And so you get a sort of a smear on the phototubes in the case of the neutron capture, and you get a nice ring in the ideal case for the charge current. So we ran for those two periods with that data, and I'll show you the latest data from this phase of the experiment. We have, over the last intervening year here, installed a series of proportional counters that enable us to look at neutrons one by one, and we're in production running with them, and we'll do so until the end of December 2006, at which point we're planning to remove the heavy water because our statistical accuracy will be better than our systematics and the experiment will be finished. I'll tell you later about what we plan to do next, replacing the heavy water with liquid scintillator. This just shows you the idea of what you can do. If you put chlorine in the water, you boost your capture probability and you boost the energy, and you also get a pattern that's quite isotropic and in comparison to the single Cherenkov cone. And so we use that information. So here's the data from the most recent paper. And we finally moved from publishing letters to publishing a real detail PhysRev paper, 46 pages, all of the experimental analysis and so on contained within it. This is the data, the blue points, as a function of effective energy of the light that's produced, the fast-moving electrons, for example, and translated into electron energy for the various processes. And the black curve is the sum of various components from the different reactions. Neutral current showing up as the light output after the neutron captures in chlorine, charged current showing up as the the energy spectrum of those electrons that's almost one-to-one with the energy spectrum of the neutrinos coming in. In the elastic scattering, the energy spectrum is smeared, and the reaction cross-section is much smaller, and there's a small amount of external neutrons that come in from outside. Now, how do we break that curve, or that data, into these curves? Well, we use the subsidiary information that you can get by keeping track of where an event occurred, what direction it's going in, and how isotropic the pattern of light on the phototubes was. And so this is the isotropy of the pattern on the phototubes, and what you can see is that the neutrons from the neutral current reaction are very different from the Cherenkov cones from the charge current reaction, and so they are used to do a statistical decomposition of the data, together with this distribution, which is the direction from the sun, which is very clear in pointing out the elastic scattering events, separating them out, and to some degree, because there's a slight dependence in the charge current reaction, sorting it out. And then finally, we make sure that we have a good radial profile. This is actually number counts versus volume, where the radius of the acrylic, radius of the heavy water, if you like, is at this point. And we take the inner 75% of the volume and thereby avoid the majority of neutrons that are produced by radioactivity outside. So when we're finished, basically the set of data that we've got there has, that's essentially neutrinos, except for maybe, except for those well-defined neutrons from outside and for maybe 10% of the neutrons in the neutral current reaction. It's a very clean situation. And that enables us to extract the energy spectrum of the neutrinos themselves from the energy spectrum of the electrons. And this is the actual spectrum of the electrons. This is what it would look like, this red line, if there was no distortion whatsoever from this MSW effect, from matter effects in the sun. And the blue line is the very small effect that's expected for the best fit to the data, the so-called LMA, or large mixing angle solution. You can see that it's not very big at these energies. What I'll show you later, since this is 6 or 5.5 MeV as the threshold, I'll show you later what you can see if you get down to 1.5 MeV, which is our objective for the future in terms of trying to track this distortion, which gets much larger at lower energies. We also look for day-night asymmetry to see if there's any interaction with electrons in the Earth, and did not see anything statistically significant. You can look at it with or without the constraint that the sum of all the active neutrinos should not show a day-night asymmetry, and our final results are on the order of 4%, plus or minus 4%, where the expected effect from the large mixing angle is only about 3% in this energy range. If you then ask, if you know that there is a mu tau component in the neutral current, in fact, that's plotted on this axis, electron component plotted on this axis, charge current reaction is only sensitive to electron neutrinos, neutral current reaction is sensitive equally to all three, giving you a slope like this. The intersection of those two is what gives you the definitive result, showing that the mu tau flux is, at this point, about 7 standard deviations away from zero. Good agreement with the results for the elastic scattering, which has some sensitivity to mu and tau. The green is the snow result, and the black is the Supercamiocanda result. And if you translate that into actual fluxes, the neutral current flux is essentially in agreement with the standard solar model prediction, and in fact that's shown on here as a dashed line. And you can see from the width of the band here that in fact our results are more accurate than can be calculated by the solar models at present. So now if you go back and look in more detail at the 1-2 parameters as fit by the incorporation of all the solar data, where the snow data is particularly constraining on the theta axis, you see this is what it looks like if you use all the solar data. If you then assume CPT and take the anti-neutrinos from the reactors that are studied by CAMLAN, you find that their data has a similar, it's a much larger region than this, but the constraint region that the two overlap is shown here, and you've really got a very tight constraint on delta m squared, and you've got enough of a constraint primarily from the snow data on the theta axis to show that in fact maximal mixing, tan squared equals 1, is disfavored by more than 5 standard deviations. So it does not appear as though the 1-2 parameters involve maximal mixing. And also because this, in the solar case, involves mass interaction, you know that mass 2 is greater than mass 1, as I showed you earlier. So we've come from a point where we didn't really know what was going on to a point where we're defining things with a fair amount of accuracy. And the objective of our third phase of the experiment is to do even better in terms of accuracy by having independent measurements of the neutral current reaction. And that we do by putting in a set of helium-3 filled nickel tubes, ultra-pure nickel produced by a process that was ironically developed by Inco. And it's also very ironic that the nickel turned out to be the most pure material we could get our hands on, since we happen to be working in a nickel mine that's putting out 5,000 tons of ore a day and may well have produced some of this nickel that ended up getting put back in the middle in an ultra-pure situation. These enable us, by this reaction on tritium, to observe a proton and a triton charged particles that give us a specific signal from these proportional counters. And by having about a half a kilometer of these in the detector, we're able to do a much more specific separation of the charge current reaction and the neutral current reaction. So our future data after 2 years of running will be more accurate than any of the phases we've had so far. It'll have completely different systematic uncertainties. And there is one other advantage to this, and that is that when it comes to taking a look at the low energy region, particularly down in here, the main uncertainty in this region is due to the fact that those neutrons do capture on deuterium, and that's a contribution that comes in around 6 million electron volts. If you put the helium in there, then you lower that by a factor of 2, and you can improve your accuracy in that region. So we're continuing with snow, and I'll show you in a moment what we'll do next with liquid scintillator in place of the heavy water. But in the meantime, the full set of physics that we've been doing with snow involves what I showed you about solar neutrinos, and we're looking at further at periodic variations in those neutrinos to look for effects in the sun. We have published a paper on the detection of potential. We set a limit on any neutrinos from the sun. We set a limit on this invisible mode from nucleon decay, and published a paper on that. And we're continually looking for the possibility of a supernova as we go forward. And we're studying muons produced either directly by cosmic rays in the atmosphere and penetrating down to this 2 kilometer depth, or muons produced by atmospheric neutrinos, where we have a bit of an advantage over other experiments because we're under a large flat region, whereas other experiments like SuperChem Ukanda are under a mountain. And so when they look off, they really can't look above the horizon because these direct muons obscure them. We're able to make a measurement up to about 45 degrees above the horizon, and we can normalize the data to 7% or so in that vicinity, which will help, in fact, with the interpretation of the atmospheric neutrino oscillations where one uses SuperChem Ukanda data below the horizon. If we can improve the fits there, because the theory right now is about 25% uncertainty in that normalization, and that's a limitation in the SuperChem Ukanda data. We're also set up to see a supernova if we look for them all the time, and we have a cell phone network of people who would analyze and come up with an answer, we hope, within a half an hour or so as to whether it is a supernova and not a power line fluctuation. We're able to tell the astronomers that one has taken place, and they have, in typical supernova, up to 2 hours to try to see the light curve developing. So the process of trying to observe a supernova and then give some advance warning is something that we're involved in. And we're in a coincidence network with other experiments around the world to be sure whether or not they have seen something, if they should have, in order to be sure. Again, we haven't got a power line fluctuation in Canada as opposed to Japan. I'm picking something that could create a distortion in the data and look like a something that would fool us. All right, it's a specific power line fluctuation that fired off 35 tubes within 2 seconds that looked exactly like the, you know, I'm just using a euphemism for an experimental effect. So, yeah. Yes. Um, 1987 was actually in the Large Magellanic Cloud, which is further away by a factor of about 3 than the center of the galaxy. And so whereas we would see, well, in fact, it's more than that, because we would see something like 1,000 events, and we'd see like 20 for something in the Large Magellanic Cloud. On the other hand, for something, the majority of the stars nearby are actually in the galaxy. And if you had something from the center of the, from 10 kiloparsecs away, which is a little more than the center of the galaxy, you would see 1,000 events and different neutrino types. And they would all happen in on the order of 2 to 10 seconds. And that's to be compared with roughly 1 hour in the category of neutrino events. And so, therefore, it would be quite distinctive. On the other hand, you can also have things like a muon come in and produce a lot of spallation and so on. You have to be careful what you're dealing with when you get extra events. Okay, so coming back for a moment, just to summarize what others are doing with respect to measurements of other parameters within this matrix. I mentioned that we know these things. People are going after 1-3. They're going after the delta function, and we're going after double beta decay. I'll tell you about this, but in detail with respect to SNOLAB, but there are other experiments that are going to address those other parameters and do them accurately and basically get at the other parameters in the matrix, and also by double beta decay tell you whether neutrinos are Dirac or Majorana and determine their mass scale more accurately. In experiments that I'll mention to you, and in addition, experiments like CAMLAND, which continue to look at reactor neutrinos and lower energy solar neutrinos, will be able to do better on the 1-2 and other physics that could influence it. There are accelerator experiments that are going to do the 2-3 parameters in more accuracy. And there are a whole raft of experiments being planned to try to, first of all, determine theta 1-3 and determine if it's large enough to have sensitivity to be able to, in future large-scale experiments, probably requiring neutrino factories, to observe the parameter delta, and to observe, for the 2-3, the interaction with the Earth in terms of matter effects. They are in Japan at Fermilab, and the neutrino factors are being debated both in Europe and really all over the world. There's a significant study of this going on in the US right now in terms of this and the things I'll tell you about for underground science in terms of the future physics to be done here. The formalism for the oscillation, if you put it all together and put in all three of the masses, gets really quite complex. But it's a set of terms. The term that would be sensitive to the theta 1-3 term is the one that you see here, and that's the first generation experiments. The terms that would be looking for CP violation that involve this parameter delta have this Jarlskog parameter out in front that has in it this 1-3 as a defining amplitude factor. And so doing it sequentially with 1-3 and then CP seems to be the only way to go experimentally. And of course, as long as you're passing through a significant amount of Earth, you have the potential also of observing the same effect of interaction with the electrons in the Earth. And from that, you can determine the sign of the relative masses, the hierarchy of neutrino masses. In addition to that, if you go to double beta decay, you get all of these parameters coming in, the masses influenced also by the phase factors I showed you earlier. And in the tritium beta decay, which is a harder experiment to get sensitivity, you have no phase factors, but you have the sum of the masses with the matrix elements influencing. The future experiments for double beta decay, next generation, will get to about 0.05 electron volts. For Catrin, the objective is something like 0.03 electron volts. In order to observe double beta decay, as I'll show you in a moment, the neutrino has to be its own antiparticle. And if you observe double beta decay, observation of double beta decay would imply Majorana neutrinos. Not that it already implies Majorana neutrinos. I'm sorry. That was a little confusing. Future observation would imply Majorana neutrinos. Just to show you the complexity of the processes that are being considered, this just shows you something from the review that's going on in the US right now. In the future, they are considering certainly several phases of double beta decay, study of PP neutrinos and other solar neutrinos, studies of reactor neutrinos, and long baseline experiments to look at all of these parameters. There's a very active neutrino program internationally. This shows you a lot of what's being considered in the US. Now in Canada, we have a real opportunity to get at some of this physics because we've been funded to produce an underground laboratory that is very deep and has room for experiments, as I showed you earlier on. And what I'll do is just give you a bit of a flavor for some of the things that we're planning to do there. I'll tell you about what we can do with snow with some liquid scintillator in it. And I'll show you the sorts of things that we're considering for the detection of dark matter and for the detection of double beta decay. Here's the laboratory. I showed you that earlier. And these are the spaces where we would host the new experiments. But Snow Plus would be basically using the existing detector, but replacing the heavy water with light water. Just to show you there's something actually happening, we've got a building that I'm going to consult with Lee and others about appropriate espresso machines, judging by what's done around here. If we're going to get any European collaborators, we're going to have good ones. And so we'll try to see what we can do with that. We take occupancy in June, and it is a above-ground staging facility for these ultra-clean underground experiments, as well as an office facility. This just shows you how deep we are compared to other experiments, and in practical terms, what the intensity of muons is at this depth. And so it's several hundred times better than the Japanese facility. These cosmic rays produce neutrons. These neutrons can either provide a background that look like a WIMP interacting with the detector, or can produce radioactivity that can obscure double beta decay. And so depth is very important, and we have a significant advantage by already being used to working at this sort of depth. So as a result of this, we've had a significant international interest in the experiment, and we've had letters of interest from this set of experiments involving measurements to look at solar neutrinos, PP neutrinos in this case. I'll tell you about Snow Plus. In the case of dark matter, one of the best performers already in the US, CDMS, is interested in a future sighting in snow. I'll tell you about Picasso, and there's a new experiment that's being developed involving simply looking at scintillation light from liquid argon that has great potential for measuring dark matter. And in terms of neutrinoless double beta decay, the Majorana experiment, which is a US-Canadian-Russian collaboration, has very good sensitivity, as does EXO, US-Canadian collaboration as well, both of them interested in sighting at SNOLAB. So what can you do if you switch from heavy water to liquid scintillator? Well, there's a variety of things you can do. I'll tell you about what we can do to test the so-called neutrino matter interaction that I was describing to you earlier that you see with this MSW effect is a very specific prediction for what you would see at lower energies. And by making a measurement with liquid scintillator of one of these reactions, the PEP reaction, which is at about 1.5 million electron volts compared to our present threshold of about 6 million electron volts, one can test that. We can also observe neutrinos from the Earth. We can observe neutrinos from the reactors in Ontario. We can continue our search for supernova, and potentially we might even be able to do double beta decay in this experiment. Pardon me? PEP? I'm just about to tell you. In the sun, you can have the PP reaction that produces low-energy neutrinos, or you can have another reaction where you get an electron capture involved, giving you a monoenergetic emission of neutrinos. It's well-defined in relationship to the PP reaction. And since this defines the solar luminosity predominantly, it's a very well-constrained number by solar models, more constrained than any other of these reactions in the sequence. PEP, this is known to about 1%. PEP is 1.5 to 2%. And so you've got a very good definition of the source of your neutrinos if you're able to observe that single line. And what we're dealing with is looking at the effect as a function of energy between what we've observed so far for boron 8 neutrinos up here at the highest energy with what you would see at 1.5 MeV, and then there are other experiments that are going to look down at the PP neutrinos. This matter interaction process, if in fact the correct and only mechanism is neutrino oscillations with the MNSP matrix, has this extra term involving the interaction with the electrons in the sun. And it turns out that if you compare this region with this region, then you find that in fact the parameters are such that up here at 10 MeV or so, you actually have the matter interaction term, this term, dominating, and in fact it's very strongly affected by the presence of matter. Down at the lower energies here, one has a situation where the term, when E gets small, this term dominates, and you have almost completely vacuum interaction. In between, which is right where the PEP reaction sits, then you have the combination of those two terms, and in fact that's why we would like to try to make a measurement of this particular monoenergetic line in the central energy region. This is what that curve looks like if you take the parameters that have been defined so far, the so-called large mixing angle solution, and look at what happens as a function of energy, and in particular what you get at about 1.5 MeV. And so making that measurement is really a detailed test of whether or not this theory involving matter interaction is correct. It's also interesting, and there have been a rash of papers in the last 6 months or so, because other interactions that can be postulated, some of them referred to as non-standard interactions, the new idea that's been put forward that you might have mass-varying neutrinos where you have a interaction between neutrinos and a scalar field associated with the dark energy, motivated in part by people's observation that the delta M for neutrinos at about 10 to the minus 3 eV or so is on the same order as what you observe for dark energy. Maybe not a strong motivation, but not an impossibility. That these things would also get involved in matter interactions in the sun and could potentially cause an effect. And these are the sorts of things that have appeared in these papers in the last 6 months. This is the curve that one would see if you have no other effects of non-standard interactions. And these are curves in both of these cases that you would observe in a situation where those interactions are present. This is what you could have, these are two different papers dealing with what could happen if you had mass-varying neutrinos interacting with the neutrino density in the sun. There are also distortion effects that can occur if sterile neutrinos are present that can constrain sterile neutrinos even further. Now, these are speculative ideas, the point being that we would like to go back and see whether what we observe by a very accurate measurement at this particular point is what you would expect without anything else added on to the standard MNSW matrix. And so what we're proposing is to put liquid scintillator in. We would be looking for a plateau in the data where the PEP are sitting on top of the CNO neutrinos from higher mass interactions in the sun. The potential of doing that with good statistical accuracy is there, and therefore we would go on to try to do that. I should say all of the things I say now and in the future are proposals, only at the proposal stage at this point, have not yet been fully funded, although we've just received development funds from NSERC to pursue this. Yes, Kirk. Yes. Yes. We would do that, and you get a factor of 40 or so more light output, typically. As a result, you're able to push your threshold of sensitivity down to the point where you're seeing these 1.5 MeV effects. You get down significantly lower in your ability to observe faint light sources in the detector. Otherwise, the detector behaves essentially the same. Except what's happening is instead of producing a Cherenkov cone, you're exciting the atoms in the scintillator and producing light of a higher intensity. And so the ability to observe lower energies is simply due to the fact that there's more light there. And so 10 phototubes firing is 40 times lower light intensity than when you have the Cherenkov process going on. So, pardon me? What was the reason for using the heavy water? Well, the reason for using it was to be able to measure two reactions. One reaction sensitive only to electron neutrinos and the other sensitive to all neutrino types. In this case, you are only going to observe, what you're going to observe is the scattering of neutrinos from the electrons in the liquid scintillator. And so it's the same mix of 6 times more electron neutrinos than other neutrino types. But you can take that into account when it comes to looking at your measurement of sensitivity as a function of energy. So, yeah. Right now, we get approximately 10 phototubes firing for 1 million electron volts of neutrino energy. Okay. There are problems, obviously, that one has to deal with when you move down in energy in terms of radioactive background. The principal ones are going to be potassium-40 and a daughter of radon that appears in the liquid scintillator, but purification techniques are available for this, and we will apply them. This is the big advantage that we have compared to other experiments putting liquid scintillator underground, such as Chemland, and that is at the Kamioka depth, the carbon 11 produced by cosmic rays interacting with the liquid scintillator, the carbon in the liquid scintillator, produces a background that is prohibitive for doing the experiment. Whereas one can do it at the greater depth in snow without much trouble. We can also look at neutrinos from the Earth and thereby attempt to understand the amount of radioactivity in the Earth's mantle and crust, and thereby attempt to understand the heat flow in the Earth. We have an ability to observe that with a significantly higher event rate because we're under the center of the continent rather than sitting on the continental shelf as Chemland is. I'm moving quickly now because I'm conscious of the time. And so the possibility of measuring geoneutrinos is there, and we would have also the opportunity of measuring events from the reactors in Ontario, which would have about 1.5 times further distance than what is observed with Chemland and would be a test by the distortion of this spectrum of what is observed in the Chemland experiment. We can still observe supernova, again, a significant number of events in the event of a supernova. And so it's new physics with a relatively small change in what we already do in snow. We have to worry about things like liquid scintillator interacting with acrylic and holding the sphere that holds it down if it's lighter rather than up when it's heavier with heavy water in it. But these are technical things that we think we can handle. Double beta decay and dark matter are the other two things I'll mention to you. Double beta decay is a process that can occur if you have emission and reabsorption, if you like, of neutrinos in the process of the emission of two electrons energetically favored by the relationship between the mass of two nuclei. That can occur if a neutrino is its own antiparticle. It also, however, requires that you have a finite mass for the neutrinos, because if they're all have a unique helicity by having zero mass, then this process is not allowed for helicity reasons. So that process would involve, if you sum together the electron energies, a unique energy. There's an allowed process that involves a continuum of energies, but what one looks for is this unique energy, but with half-lives that are on the order of 10 to the 26 years or so. So you need a lot of atoms if you're going to only sit there for 10 years if you're going to make this sort of measurement. And so the typical experiments that are being considered in the next generation are a few hundred kilograms of material that enables you to have good resolution to see that little peak. It turns out that the formula that involves these phase factors also involves the question of the relative hierarchy between 2 and 3, which, as I said earlier, is not known. We do know 2 to 1. And so the effective mass that you observe can be anywhere, actually, below about 400 kilovolts as measured so far. And there's even a somewhat disputed measurement that would say that perhaps it is at, sorry, not 400 kilovolts, 400 millielectron volts, 0.4 electron volts. An experiment by Klapdor et al. That is not yet definitive, and which a lot of people are working to test, but it does suggest that there might be a mass up in this region where you have a degeneracy among the masses of neutrinos. What I'm plotting here is the effective mass you observe in the experiment, which influences how big a peak you get at the end, compared to the lightest neutrino mass in electron volts. And so this region here is going to be accessible to the next generation of experiments, and there's a variety of different materials that are being considered for this. One of the ones that's highest priority for SNOW, and high priority also in the U.S. community, is an experiment involving enriched germanium. Standard detector for radiation, although in this case enhanced by segmenting the detectors significantly and measuring the pulse shape from the detectors. But again, it has to be ultra clean, ultra low background. It has to be deep enough that cosmic rays don't produce background in the detectors. And so SNOW Lab is apparently the place of choice for this particular experiment. These other processes of looking at signal shape and segmentation can reduce the background significantly. And it looks as though one can get 0.05 electron volts in a few years of counting. There's another large experiment being planned in the United States, or being developed in the United States, involving enriched liquid xenon. And it also has the capability in the longer term of getting down into this same energy region. And we've been working on the possibility of putting things like neodymium into the liquid scintillator, allowing the two electrons to be emitted to produce light in the liquid scintillator. And what we would see with 10 tons of neodymium, which is still only 1% of that 1,000 tons of liquid scintillator, what we would see is a peak, which ends up looking like a distortion on that two neutrino background, but large enough to be distinctive. That's many standard deviations with 1 year of running at 0.15 electron volt sensitivity. SNOW Lab is a great place for all of these. It's also a great place particularly for the detection of dark matter, because the neutron background that you get from the cosmic rays in the other labs is significantly higher. The way you detect dark matter is for a WIMP to hit a nucleus as a result of the motion of the sun and the earth and produce a very small recoil. Now, seeing that that happens in comparison to the other radioactivity that can produce various light, heat, and charge effects in materials is a big challenge. And this is just the names of experiments using different combinations of heat, charge, and light in doing experiments. The idea of using different combinations is that you get a different sensitivity to these parameters if the nucleus recoils or if the material is ionized by, for example, gamma and beta radioactivity. And so let me show you two experiments with different rather novel techniques that are aiming at measurements in the SNOW lab. One looks for the formation of a tiny bubble for a fluorine-based supersaturated gel, which is sensitive primarily to spin-dependent interactions of WIMPs, harder to detect. The current sensitivity of experiments so far is up at this region. Picasso is about to come out with a result with about a kilogram of target. That's the droplet detector. In future, they can go down significantly further, and these are a variety of different models for WIMPs that have spin-dependent interactions. Similarly, liquid argon scintillation is another thing that is being proposed. Right now, the limits set by CDMS, which itself will get future sensitivity improved by at least a factor of 100, is up at this region. The equivalent graph, if you put on it where predictions of minimal supersymmetric models producing the lightest supersymmetric particle as the WIMP comes into this region here. With 1,000 kilograms of liquid argon, one can get way down into the region where one is predicting effects from a variety of minimal supersymmetric models. So, deepliness is great. Cleanliness is even better when you combine it. We've defined a lot of neutrino properties already by these measurements. We've got a lot of things we can do in the future, and SNOW Lab gives us a great opportunity to do it. And then finally, this is the set of people that have worked on SNOW starting back in 1984, and it's up to a list of about 250 people now. At any given time, we have about 120 people working on the experiment, and that's great because it means that that other half of the group are predominantly students, postdocs, who have moved on to other things. And so these are my collaborators, and it's to them that we owe the success we've had so far. Thanks. Yes. There are limits that are set, for example, by Super-Kamiokande on those events that are they're not far off of the sort of limits that I was showing you. They end up in a slightly different region, but they're on the graph for the spin-independent interaction, I know, and they have not observed anything, but the sensitivity is comparable, harder, however, to extend. So, yeah. Okay. Yes. How many? Well, we know.